Mister, that's a mighty big dog you got there.
Help me, Jesus! Help me, Jewish God! Help me, Allah! Ah! Help me, Tom Cruise!
It's Linderman Unleashed on Natural News Radio.
You tell him I'm coming, and hell's coming with me, you hear?
All opinions and views expressed on Linderman Unleashed are strictly those of the host and guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of Natural News Radio. Warning, this program might cause you to think for yourself. Listener discretion is advised. And now, here's your host, Kurt Linderman.
That's right. Welcome to Linderman Unleashed. I am your host, Kurt Linderman Sr., in the studio with my lovely wife and co-host, Kimberly, once again bringing you the bare-knuckled right hook of truth to any that would try to put the chokehold on your liberty and health freedom. Once again, welcome to the show. We've got a really special guest I told you about. I alluded to it yesterday on the program. And not only is she one of our very dearest friends, but she's an integral part of Linderman Unleashed. She is my producer. She is the wonderful voice that you hear at the beginning of my show, of our show. And she's as integral a part of Linderman Unleashed as myself and Kimberly. Joni Cox, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Kurt. Thank you so much for a great introduction.
Well, I'll tell you what. We're also going to have you on in the next week or two, and we're probably going to allude to that towards the end of the program of why we're going to have you back on. But you called me yesterday. Well, of course, we talk every day, but we were talking about the radio program and everything. And you sent me this fabulous book that is just one of those books from way back in the day that people like us would just sit back and read and go, oh my God, they did get it back then. Why do they still not get it now?
Oh yeah. I'm actually in a quite experimental phase in my own life with my diet and trying to heal injuries, you know, gut internal injuries and different things in my own life. And a good friend that I met recently, Matt Stone of 180 Degree Health, has been literally frying my brain with all these new ideas and quotes and things that make me challenge what I thought I previously knew, and I just love him for it. But he mentioned the name Bernard McFadden to me the other day, and I was like, ooh, who's that? And boy, I have been on the rabbit trail ever since.
And you and I spoke about it. You sent me the Google copy of the book, of which we're going to put a link up on the Linderman Unleashed fan page on Facebook. The name of the book, Vaccination Superstition, The Vaccination Superstition, a prophylaxis to be realized through the attainment of health, not by the propagation of disease. It's by J.W. Hodge, M.D. of Niagara Falls, New York, but the introduction is by Bernard McFadden, and then it just moves on with a number of different chapters that are just absolutely amazing. We're talking on cell phones right now. Those of you that listened to the previous interview we had this week, we are having some issues with our phone. I think the audio is coming through just fine. So I don't think we're going to have a big problem with that. But you have notes in front of you. We both read the book. It's an amazing read. Give me your thoughts like you expressed them to me over the telephone and via text messages when you first started reading it.
Well, when I first started reading it, one of the things that struck me is that Bernard McFadden is making some of the same observations that we make today in like an anti-vaccine setting, or someone who's, you know, opposing of vaccines or critical of them. We're seeing some of the same things, like vaccines are poisoning blood. Blood is sacred, as in, you know, Dr. Tim O'Shea's book. And I'm floored that, you know, as I read more and more into medical history, that there were actually a large number of doctors, physicians, lay people, anybody in the medical profession who really opposed vaccines. There was a huge anti-vaccination movement in the early 1900s and in the late 1800s, and here we never know anything about it today. So I almost feel like we're unearthing this and rediscovering this whole new, like a path that was paved for us long ago, and now we're just kind of unearthing it like archaeologists.
Right. That is exactly it. And it's very exciting to hear that all of these doctors, I mean, this book doesn't have just the opinion of one doctor in it. As I said, there's a number of doctors writing different chapters in this book, and many of them were very, very pronounced, very, prominent physicians of their day. And some of the insights that they have here, as you said, Joni, very insightful and very distinct to the problems we're seeing to this very day.
Yeah, and a lot of times these were men who were, the heads of public health departments. And even in one instance in the book, city of Cleveland, it was a highly populated area, and I guess we could get started there. Dr. Friedrich actually eliminated smallpox by going door to door and having every home sanitized. And they had a very specific way they sanitized. Now, I would not use formaldehyde this day to sanitize my home. They used formaldehyde to sanitize everybody's home instead of injecting it into them, you know? And so they actually were able to eradicate smallpox in the town of Cleveland, Ohio. He freed the entire city, got permission from the mayor, and the mayor actually sent him help and agreed to it.
That was the amazing thing. The title of that chapter is A City Freed from Smallpox. And it actually says, to Dr. Friedrich, in charge of the Health Board of Cleveland, Ohio, is due the credit of furnishing the civilized world with an example of a large city being absolutely free from smallpox. And it would be well to note that one of the first means that he adopted in producing this result was to abolish vaccination absolutely. And like you said, not only did he get the mayor's he just said, hey, yeah, let's do this, got rid of the vaccines, and even provided help to this doctor to go out there, and they actually had these little sprayers, I guess, these little pump sprayers, and they sprayed the homes and cleaned up the trash and made sure the water was clean and did all the things that we talk about today that would make people healthy.
Yeah, well, some of the statistics with that, as it says, the disease raged uninterruptedly since 1898. They relied on vaccination and quarantine as the most effective weapons to combat it, but smallpox rates doubled every year. Starting at the year 1900, they had 993 cases from January 1, 1901 to July 21st, 1901. That went up to 1,223 cases. Dr. Friedrich found that disinfecting with the formaldehyde could, and once they did that to the homes, they could never trace another case of smallpox to that home. And one quarter of the population of that town, they were vaccinated, and it didn't take.
Yeah, that's the other thing. Now, you gave the numbers from from January 1st to July 21st, 1901. They had 1,223 cases. Now, this happened from 1901 in April till April 1st, 1902. Not a single case after Dr. Friedrich talked the mayor into stopping the vaccines and going in and cleaning the homes. And the other thing that they did is if somebody were to come down with smallpox, what they did was they isolated that person and cleaned their surroundings.
Right. And they probably gave them some tips on how to be hygienic as well. I want to go back and fix what I quoted there about one quarter of the people vaccinated didn't take. It said all the cases of the people who were vaccinated and it didn't take, they all developed sepsis as a result. I just forgot to add that part in and didn't further read, a little bit further. So I did want to just clarify and correct that real quick.
Right. Now, and one of the things they said in this chapter is never another case could be traced to one of the houses that they found that they disinfected with formaldehyde that had an issue with smallpox. But they said that regarding many of the untoward symptoms that really kind of brought about this mayor saying, okay, I'm seeing the issues with these vaccines. Some of the symptoms frequently that it didn't take at all. One-fourth of all cases developed sepsis, like you said. Some arms swelled clear down to the wrist joint. with pieces of flesh as big as a silver dollar and twice as thick dropping right off the arm, leaving an ugly, suppurated wound, which to heal took in many cases over 3 months. 4 cases of tetanus developed after vaccination. So that's when the people became alarmed, and Dr. Friedrich came in and talked to the mayor and said, look, let's stop this insanity. Let's just clean up and teach these people a good diet and clean living, and we could take care of this disease. And it worked out flawlessly.
Right, it did. And, you know, everybody around there knew that at that time, you know, vaccines were in definite question. And as you read further on into the book, some of the things that we'll talk about here soon is just completely mind-blowing. It's the vaxxed unvaxxed study. They are the original vaxxed unvaxxed studies that we have unearthed here.
Yeah, and it's really amazing. Now, keep in mind also, Cleveland, at the time that they were having these smallpox issues, it was the most infected city in America, and it turned out to be the cleanest and with no infection whatsoever, with no vaccines. That's really telling.
It really is, and he formed two squads of disinfectors. He preferred to have medical students as well. Now, you know, that's something that you really don't see anymore these days, is getting actual med students to listen to an alternative form of health. But he, after 3 months, eradicated the city. And only after 3 months, it went from the absolute worst to the absolute best.
Right. And I think the other thing that we have to talk about here is we might be thinking of these doctors as the doctors we think of today, the allopathic physicians. But keep in mind, when we talk on this program about the Flexner Report and the Rockefellers, it wasn't until around 1918 to the early 20s before the Rockefellers got a hold of the medical profession. There's a very distinct probability that this particular doctor probably worked as much, I would say more than probably, I would say it's almost guaranteed that this doctor worked as much with homeopathy than he did with allopathic medicine.
Well, you know, I mean, I might agree with you on that, but I can't say I agree 100%, only because I know that the grounds were being laid, and for, you know, the mid-1900s and what you were just talking about with the Rockefellers, I really think that, you know, the things that were in the works were at that time. It just hadn't been made quite official yet. But I know that there was a really distinct separation between those who believed in vaccination and those who didn't. And the doctors who did not even received quite a bit of problems as a result of it. I mean, I could just read you one quote here from from Bernard McFadden. He says, "The advocates of vaccination unhesitatingly assert that the vaccine disease protects its subjects from smallpox, but the facts, so far as we know them, do not warrant this assertion. Indeed, the theory which assumes to conserve health by propagating disease has always had a formidable array of facts to oppose it." And he talks about, even from the days of Jenner to the present time, cases of smallpox have appeared among those who were supposed to be protected by vaccination. And he, you know, definitely talks about the doctors selling vaccination to the masses, going door to door, having mandated vaccines even back then, making sure that populations were fully vaccinated, or at least over 90% vaccination rate. And that I think the only thing we're seeing there is we didn't have the cap on the mainstream. They didn't have the same censorship in the media that we do now, because they actually reported real numbers of even, you know, soldiers dying and 30,000 plus people being hospitalized with smallpox after being vaccinated.
Yeah, now I do agree with you. Right back to the original smallpox vaccine over in England, we're talking about a certain number of doctors that really pushed this. What I was getting at is these doctors that are writing this book probably still work as much with homeopathy. They're understanding that you don't inject a body with disease to prevent disease. They're kind of getting the whole clean living type thing that would really be sufficient, you know? The other thing that I found kind of weird, and I guess I haven't researched it enough, Joni, and Kim, you might want to chime in on this too. I was always under the impression with the way that allopathic medical professionals today speak about the scourge of smallpox back in the 1800s and 1700s, I almost thought it was almost plague-like, and it was a relatively small number of people that actually died from the disease. And I never got that impression when listening to the modern-day doctors talk about smallpox.
That smallpox was almost plague-like. I mean, really, I knew that, you know, there were hundreds of thousands of deaths around the world, and that it was even likened unto the Black Death, the plague.
That's the impression I always got.
Right, but, you know, we just didn't realize that there were large amounts of populations that actually survived, and that it was absolutely the vaccinated that were more likely to die from it or experience, you know, debilitating lifetime illnesses as a result. Just like here, November 24th, 1870, the London Morning Advertiser reported, quote, smallpox is making still greater havoc in the ranks of the Prussian army, which is said to have 30,000 smallpox patients in its hospitals. All these patients were vaxxed and revaxxed.
Yeah, that's one thing that they did a lot with the soldiers, is it was almost like they vaccinated them, and then next time they thought the disease was coming around in the spring or something, they would always revaccinate them. That's one thing I did see. Now, in the vaccination superstition, starting in one of the chapters, it says, in view of the fact that a bold attempt has recently been made by a representative of the self-styled regular profession to place upon our statute books a compulsory vaccination measure, the provisions of which mark a height of brazen effrontery which medical despotism has never before reached in the Empire State, and inasmuch as the public mind is largely occupied with the questions of smallpox and vaccination at the present, the discussion of some phases of these subjects seems timely and appropriate. This is, I mean, I kind of like the way they talked and wrote back then, but the main reason I read that was because he did represent that the people out there really pushing vaccines as the regular profession. So you are right there in saying they had already turned that corner. As far as vaccines go, they really had already turned that corner, and these doctors were kind of on the edge there.
Yeah, and I can go back to like the 3rd century, and really when I study the beginnings of natural health, when you look at Hippocrates and you look at the Greeks, I've gone back as far as like 3 AD and have really tried to look hard at the founding philosophies behind modern medicine and why and where we've, you know, gotten these ideas from, you know. And there were really two foundational philosophies back then. One were the vitalists and the others were the atomists. And, you know, the atomists were more the ones who were likely to cut open dogs and cats to try to look at organs and figure out where we were at and use things like mercury, because mercury was a huge, you know, healer that they used to treat illnesses and viruses and stuff. And that was a really popular medicine. And then you have your vitalists, like, you know, Hippocrates. I will give no thing to harm a woman or a pregnant woman. First, do no harm. You know, he had a lot of ethics and morals in which he lived by, and we really just seem to have adapted that other philosophy, you know, and gotten away from the vitalistic philosophy of, you know, let your food be your medicine and your medicine be your food, because they found that, of course, you know, the birth of the pharmaceutical companies and everything else that goes with that, they found that some of these, you know, harmful chemicals obviously can make them more money if they sell it to them. Like, obviously now we would not clean our houses with formaldehyde.
Right. Yeah, no doubt. I think the other thing that really brought this initial pushback about vaccinations was the fact that this wasn't even the smallpox disease that they were injecting and poisoning people with. This was cowpox. And
right.
And I think that really, that whole idea of, you know, this guy is making these claims and it's purely on hypothesis, and everybody's taking this and just running with it.
Right.
So I think that was a big part.
Well, and Jenner really had to live with seeing the death of his belief system. I mean, he was just based on a hypothesis, you know, first and foremost. And ultimately, he had to, you know, watch the demise of his hypothesis crumble, because he thought that you would get lifelong immunity if the vaccine took. And, you know, come to find out, he didn't. He lived to witness folly of error, is what the book says.
Right, no doubt. And the other thing is, when as this book moves, as you move through this book, and it is a relatively, it's a really easy read as long as you can get through the older style of writing. It's really damning on the vaccine. Dr. G.F. Kolb of the Royal Statistical Commission of Bavaria stated, "In the Kingdom of Bavaria, where no one for many years except the newly born escaped vaccination," I'm talking really no one, they had like a 99% vaccine rate, okay? There were in the epidemic of 1871 no less than 30,742 cases of smallpox, of whom 29,429 had been vaccinated. So 90% of those that got smallpox were vaccinated. That's amazing. And then when you think about it, there was only 1,000 people in that area. Well, actually, what, 550 people that were unvaccinated that got that disease. So what does that tell you? I don't know what the population is, but when you look at the what I've seen here and what I've been researching, the average is about 20% of the population gets smallpox if there is an epidemic, if you will. So you got to figure, if that's 20%, then you're looking at what, right around 150,000 people in that area. And out of 30,742 cases of smallpox in that area, only about 500 or 600 that caught the disease were unvaccinated. You know, that's amazing. That tells you that there's a lot more people out there that were unvaccinated and didn't get the disease than those that were vaccinated that did get the disease. I hope that makes sense.
Right. Yeah, no, I was just going to actually say, I did the math on that, and it's 1,313, the difference between the 30,742 and the 29,429. And they had been vaxxed according to all the documents of the State Department. And so it's like, here they have concrete evidence. And I love the fact that we have, that they kept records of all of this.
Yeah, they did.
Because now we're going back and we're going, oh my gosh, look at how many people were vaccinated and still got sick. And yeah, I mean, I'm ready to, they even have a quote in here from The Lancet that talks about the deaths over in England. They had over 10,000 deaths in England and Wales, and they just said it was assumed proportions of a plague, because the deaths from smallpox, they just assumed it in epidemic proportions like a plague. And they said they had a 73% vaccination rate. Mortality was 17.5%, and they had more than 122,000 that were vaccinated, and they all suffered from the smallpox.
That's amazing. That really is, and that's very telling. And as far as the whole idea of, well, you know, doctors are going to say now, yeah, but that they were angry about the kind of vaccine it was. We make vaccines a lot better now than we did then, and they might have been right to think bad about this particular action, but that shouldn't reflect upon the way we do it now. It absolutely does, because it's still injecting disease into people.
Right, and you know, I have this thought too, because later on in the book you'll read from J.W. Hodge, and I kind of recall this from the top of my head here, but J.W. Hodge was actually someone who was a health vaccinator, is what he called. He was like the head of a health department, and he actually went door to door to make sure everyone in that house had some kind of proof of vaccination, or, you know, and if they couldn't convince him that they'd been vaccinated, he would vaccinate them. And I just, it really shocked me that they had mandatory vaccination back then. I just kind of thought in the early 1900s, people had more health freedoms than that, or that it really wasn't as much of a concern. But it was really an agenda that they were still pushing, thinking that they were doing the right thing. But with the cowpox and with the smallpox vaccine, I actually think that it was a better product, more pure than what we inject now today. And this being because he made mention in the book that he would receive fresh lymph, is what they would call it, and it was made just 3 days prior to him injecting it into somebody, taken from the actual pus from the source.
Yeah, so you didn't have to put all those preservatives in it and put all the crap in it, and of course many preservatives weren't. You know, well, hell, they were spraying their house with formaldehyde, so they didn't have a lot of stuff to go with there. So yeah, you're probably right. It probably was a purer form than what we do have now. That I never thought about it that way.
Yeah, I just happened to take note of that because I thought, gee, you know, how much stuff could possibly be in that compared to all of the things and ingredients that we have in ours now.
Yeah, there's no doubt.
If you want to call cow pus pure.
Yeah. Well.
Ew.
Well.
No, I just.
Sorry, I just had to say that. Yeah. I'm thinking.
No, I was hoping to be quiet so you could talk.
What were they thinking?
Well, now, in this annual report of the Health Department of the City of New York in 1870 to 71, it stated, and this is from the health department, the annual report. Like you were saying, Joni, what we were saying about, they really did keep the true records. It was before they really tried to cover all this stuff up. It says, this extraordinary prevalence of smallpox over various parts of the globe, especially in countries where vaccination has long been efficiently practiced, its occurrence in its most fatal form, talking about the smallpox, in persons who gave evidence of having been well vaccinated, and the remarkable susceptibility of people of all ages to revaccination, are new facts in the history of this pestilence, which must lead to reinvestigation of the whole subject of vaccination and of its claim as a protecting agent. That is right there. They are rethinking this and saying, wait a minute, we're vaccinating these people. And if the more vaccinated you are, the more likely you're to catch it, and the greater the mortality rate. So we really need to sit down and rethink this.
Yeah, and that was from the Health Department of New York City.
Yeah.
And, you know, I really wish that the Lancet would report like they did in this book as well back there in the 1870s. I have a quote here that they said, "This is an alarming state of things. Can we greatly wonder that the opponents of vaccination should point to such statistics as an evidence of the failure of the system? It is necessary to speak plainly on this important matter."
Yeah, right. They would have been hauled before the GMC.
Exactly.
That's just crazy. In Toronto, we had some other stuff, correct? In this book.
Yeah, and there was an old school physician in Toronto, and he wrote about smallpox taking place in Montreal. And what I have here real quick in my notes is, in 1885, he called vaccination utterly useless as protection.
Yeah, that's what he said. He says, whoever closely watched the course of that epidemic in Montreal, it was utterly useless. It was ridiculous. That was A.M. Ross. And much of what transpired in our smallpox hospital was suppressed, especially whatever was likely to operate against the progress of vaccination, which proves the golden harvest to the vaccinators. But notwithstanding the conspiracy of silence, a few official reports came out, pregnant with proof against vaccination and demonstrating beyond question that a large proportion of the patients admitted to our smallpox hospitals had been vaccinated and that many of them died. And they had the vaccine marks on their body to prove it as they were doing the autopsies or burying them or whatever. The vast majority of those that had died had them marks on their bodies proving that they had been vaccinated.
Yeah, and I even recall him saying something like even 2 or 3 marks on each body.
Right, yeah, talking about being revaccinated, you know, over and over again, and yet they were still the vast majority of the ones in the smallpox hospitals.
Right, right. And, you know, moving right along, I guess, to the Italian study, I was really floored with, you know, everything that was taking place with that. You know, I mean, here again, here we are, hundreds of years later, well, a little over 100, and we're going, wait a minute, you know, we're fighting the same battle here. We have the same, you know, Dr. Sherry Tenpenny and all of the colleagues there, you know, and everyone else in the industry who are standing up and saying, wait a minute, this just defies simple immunology. This defies simple basic body function. Why can't we rethink this?
Right. There's no doubt about that. And ladies and gentlemen, if as you're listening to this, this is the big thing to Joni and Kim and I and all of the other ones out there fighting the absurdity that is vaccination is we have been talking about this, just like Joni talked about Dr. Tenpenny and her compatriots. We have been talking about this as parents for so long, and it really is nice just to look back at some of these books that were written and go, wow, yeah, I mean, it sucks that we're still out there fighting the same battle, but it's nice to know that they were fighting it back then, too, because could you imagine where we would be today if they weren't fighting it back then?
Well, that, and, you know, it just confirms all the studies that we've done. I mean, because most of America, we don't have a real good glimpse of medical history. We think that they were really archaic back then, that they couldn't possibly know as much about the human body as we do now with all of our technology. Yet, there are still some foundational, fundamental principles and just like a law system, a value system that, you know, there are certain things you don't mess with. And I think that's been carried through time for a while now.
Yeah, there's no doubt about that. Now, talking about this Italian study, basically what they were saying is in this Italian study, Italy, they say at the time, this Professor Ruotta, who prefaces his article with the fact that Italy is one of the best vaccinated countries in the world. Now, this was back in the 1800s. And he says, and we can prove that mathematically because of all of our men had to go into the service. And they're saying that literally 98.5% vaccination rate back in the late 1800s.
Yeah, and isn't he like a true Italian? I love Italians, by the way, but isn't he like a true Italian? He's just so proud. We were the best vaccinated country.
yeah. There's no doubt. And, you know, the other thing is he talks about the fact that, you know, there's no questioning this. He talks about the fact that we have the best records. There is no questioning what's going on here. And he says that vaccination in that country has been a complete and certain failure is what he says. Really, really crazy. Now, that's from Frank Foster, who wrote this, okay? And then Vaccination in Italy was written by Charles Ruotta, MD, Professor of Hygiene and Materia Medica at the University of Perugia in Italy. And it's quite telling as well that, boy, the ones that got vaccinated were the ones that got the disease and the ones most likely to die. And we're still seeing it to this day.
Yeah, he and especially among our soldiers, you know, they are still being, you know, experimented on, in my opinion, especially that was proven with the Gulf War syndrome and it was the first Gulf War. It's a very hard truth to come to grips with. It's really, really hard to think that this is what's happening to our soldiers. My brother-in-law, God bless him, he's a Marine, and I love him dearly, and it just always scares me every time he goes over on deployment, because I know what's being injected into his body, and you think, okay, well, he's okay right now, but you really don't see what's going on the inside till later sometimes.
Right, and I think we're going to see a lot of that. I was in the military. I got a lot of vaccines, not near as many as they're given to these poor men and women now, but I worry about it every day. When's it going to pop up with me? If it, you know, in some ways, if it hasn't already, and, you know, just not able to see it yet. But, yeah, I mean, we're talking of so many vaccines with the military, and that is very, very frightening because there are no, and they are experimental. They're using the squalene there. They're using things that they won't even tell the people what they're injecting them with, and that's frightening.
Right, it is. And if you don't do your homework and do not choose to become knowledgeable about these things, then you're not going to know. And, you know, all you have to do is really, you know, study the immune response and what happens anytime you're given an injection and how much different your body responds to something that's subcutaneously injected. It responds very inflammatorily, you know, it responds with an inflammation response and with a panic response versus something that says, oh, okay, I'm getting a disease, I'm going to create antibodies to it, I'm going to build immunity to it. That is not the response that you see. And even in this Italian study, he said that, you know, deaths were greater among those successfully vaccinated than in those in whom it didn't take. Now, my question is, how did they know whether it took or not?
You know, that was one of my questions, too, because if they both had the disease, the ones that had – both of them had the vaccine. One, they say it didn't take. The other, it did take, but they're both sick with it. How do they tell? Or is it the ones that didn't get sick that got vaccinated? Are they assuming that that's the one that took?
I don't know. Maybe – I mean, did they have some kind of titers test back then?
I can't imagine.
Or maybe the ones that it took, they all died, and that's how they knew it took.
Yeah.
Well, according to the study, it says that the soldiers that were vaxxed were 2 times more likely to be attacked by smallpox than those who were unprotected through, you know, the vaccine not taking.
So then you got to think, they're getting it from the vaccine. I mean, that's been my thought the whole time you two have been talking about it. The ones that died were over-vaccinated, and the vaccines took. Did they actually get it from the vaccine?
Well, I don't know, because the vaccine was actually cowpox, not smallpox. So I don't know. But,
so did they die from cowpox?
Well, I think the main thing would have been if the ones that were heavily revaccinated over and over again, that had to have been such an assault on their immune system that when the slightest amount of illness came around them, especially a smallpox, their body was in no shape to take care of it.
Right, and you know, I think we're raising good questions here about, you know, trying to figure out how immunity was gained and how they measured that immunity. I mean, if they were able to take blood, I don't know. I mean, it would be something else, a good thing to look into.
Yeah, I think so as well. Now, let's talk a little bit. I don't know if you have this in your notes, Joni. Alfred Russel Wallace, he was a co-discoverer with Darwin of the theory of evolution. He was an expert statistician and what they call one of the most ablest scientific men of England. Now, he wrote a work entitled The Wonderful Century, where he devoted a chapter to the consideration of the most trustworthy statistics on a large scale as relating to smallpox and vaccination. And it was regarding, basically, Queen Victoria back in 1889. She appointed this commission. Do you have any of your notes on that?
I did not take notes on that, but I'm just going to go ahead and look and double check. I hand wrote all of these notes because I don't think it would let me print it out.
Well, I know you read it, so let me just talk about it a little bit, and I'm sure it will jog your memory.
She
got a commission of 8 of the most distinguished medical men of England and quite a number of eminent men in other professions to investigate the question of the effect of vaccination. And when the commission... What they're told in this book, what they're recounting in this book, spent more than 7 years on this investigation. Now, this sounds like right back to the CDC. They had 7 years. They only did 136 meetings, but they only examined 200 witnesses. So it sounds like the CDC kind of got their whole thing from there. They're 365 days in a damn year, and in 7 years they could have 136 meetings. They weren't real hep on figuring this out, you know. But they investigated 6 epidemics, which occurred in Gloucester, Sheffield, Warrington, Dewsbury, Leicester, which we're going to definitely talk about here, and London. Upon the evidence presented in the majority report of this commission, Professor Wallace bases his statements and conclusions, some of which are present here. He critically examined the early tests employed by the advocates of vaccination to prove the alleged protective influence of the practice, and has pointed out the fallacy and complete inefficiency of these tests. He has brought together an array of remarkable test cases which illustrate the utter worthlessness of vaccination. worthlessness. And then one of the things that they talk about is Leicester. And we need to spend the last, like, at least 15 of the last 20 minutes here talking about Leicester. Explain to our audience, Joni, why we should all be looking at Leicester.
Because Leicester was truly the first unvaxxed, vaxxed study that we've been screaming for the last 10 years in America. Here it is in history back in the late 1800s.
That's right. Now explain this. You, in fact, it was really weird because I'm sitting in my easy chair this afternoon reading this book and you text me and you go, holy crap, I've got the first vaxxed unvaxxed study. And I texted you back and said, you mean Leicester? And you said, yep. And we were like, it was like we were reading it at the same time.
Yeah, because here we have been screaming for it and it's already been done. And, you know, with what I believe to be less vaccines and more simple ingredients, or at least purer form of ingredient. It's like Kimberly said, you call it pure, but, you know, it just doesn't have as many chemicals in it as what they have now. And my whole thing is, my goodness, if they're experiencing with one vaccine back then some of the same stuff that we're experiencing now, what are the implications then for the added combo, you know, vaccines that they didn't even have the technology to make, nor probably the thought process to even think of making?
Right, and the other thing is, this could basically be looked at as an epidemiological study nowadays, looking back at this, but the numbers were dramatic. We're not talking about a small town of 500 and a town next to it of 600.
No, we're talking about 200,000 people.
Right, and that's the key. This is a major, major breakthrough that right here on paper with wonderful records proving this. This is the first vaxxed-unvaxxed study.
Yes, and I'm going to let you go ahead and tell those numbers because I did not have a chance to write those down.
Okay, here we have, let me just read from this because this is very important. Of Leicester, which for the past 20 years has rejected vaccination till it has now almost vanished and smallpox is almost unknown. The second is that of the Army and Navy, in which for a quarter of a century, every recruit has been revaccinated unless he had been recently vaccinated or had smallpox. So whatever recently is, recently could be a month, 6 months, a year, but if they were still in the Army and it had been past that, boom, if he hadn't had a case of smallpox, he was going to get the vaccine again. So we've got Leicester, which for the past 20 years, virtually no vaccines whatsoever, and virtually no smallpox, and then the other test subjects are the Army and Navy, okay? In the first, we had an almost unvaccinated population of nearly 200,000, which, on the theory of the vaccinators, should have suffered exceptionally from smallpox, especially when you think 200,000 people and you thought of smallpox as being the kind of disease that ravaged the impoverished big cities, you know? And then in the other, we have picked a body of nearly 220,000 men who, on the evidence of the medical authorities, are as well protected as they know how to make them, and among whom, therefore, smallpox should be almost or quite absent, and smallpox deaths quite unknown. Let us see, then, what has happened in these two cases. In both, it has been clearly proven that smallpox increased with the increase of vaccination and decreased under sanitation, cleanliness, and hygienic living. After having set forth page upon page of these test cases, Professor Wallace observes, "It is thus completely demonstrated that all the statements by which the public has been gulled or fooled on for so many years as to the almost complete immunity of the revaccinated Army and Navy are absolutely false. It is all what Americans call bluff. There is no immunity. They have no protection. When exposed to infection, they do suffer just as much as other populations or even more. In the whole of the 19 years, this is from 1878 to 1896, inclusive Unvaccinated Leicester had so few smallpox deaths that the Register General represented the average by the decimal 0.01 per 1,000 population. In other words, I think it was almost, he had to put something down there. So he, out of 1,000, he put 0.01 as the amount of deaths, the mortality rate in Leicester, unvaccinated town, okay, equal to 10 per million. While for the 12 years in that 78 to 89, there was less than one death per annum. Here we have real immunity, real protection, and it all comes from sanitation, okay? That's the key here. Now, the other thing is, do you have the numbers for the Army-Navy?
No, I don't, but I know they're really significant, and they give them, like, in the tens of thousands at a time.
Right. Now, says Professor Wallace, if there exists such a thing as a crucial test, this of the Army and Navy is compared with Leicester affords such a test. This is what we're talking about, vaxxed, unvaxxed study here. The populations concerned are hundreds of thousands. The time extends over a generation. The statistical facts are clear and indisputable, folks. While the case of the Army and Navy has been falsely alleged again and again to afford indisputable proof of the value of vaccination, Professor Wallace produces official statistics which verify his affirmation that the town of Leicester is and has been for the past 20 years the least vaccinated town in the kingdom. This is from public records, okay? Its average population, we've already talked a little bit about that. I want to talk about, before leaving Leicester, says Professor Wallace, it will be instructive to compare it with other towns we're going to look at the other towns. I'm sorry about getting to that. The average population from 1873 to 1894 was about two-thirds of that of the Army during the same period. Yet smallpox deaths in the Army and Navy were 37 per million. Those of Leicester under 15 per million. In fact, they were saying 10 per million. So almost four times as many deaths with the vaccinated Army and Navy than there were in the unvaccinated town of Leicester. That is the first vaxxed unvaxxed study that I've ever heard about.
Yeah, me too. And it was kind of a little gold nugget in this book because I wasn't expecting it. I wasn't expecting to find something this significant in a book written in the early 1900s.
Yeah, there's no doubt. And they even go on with Leicester representative of the other town of Birmingham. Now, Leicester, keep in mind, they had, before leaving Leicester, says Professor Wallace, it will be instructive to compare it with some other towns of which statistics are available. And first, as to the great epidemic of 1871-72 in Leicester and in Birmingham. Now, keep in mind, both towns at that time were well vaccinated, and this is one of the reasons why Leicester became unvaccinated. They saw, hey, you're vaccinating the crap out of us, and we're still dropping like flies. That's how they became unvaccinated. They both suffered severely by the epidemic. Leicester, smallpox cases, 327. Smallpox deaths, 35. In Birmingham, 213 smallpox cases, 35 deaths. Now, this is what they say about it, though. But since then, Leicester has rejected vaccination to such an extent that in 1894 it had only 7 vaccinations to 10,000 population, while Birmingham had 240 or more than 30 times as many, and the proportion of its inhabitants who had been vaccinated is probably less than one half of that of Birmingham. Okay, the commissioners themselves state that disease smallpox was brought into the town of Leicester on 12 separate occasions during the recent epidemic, yet the following is the result. So there you had, when they were both vaccinated, they had roughly the same amount of cases and the exact same amount of deaths. Now, after Leicester rejected vaccinations, from 1891 to 1894, smallpox cases in Leicester, 19. In Birmingham, 63. The deaths, it basically says here, it's kind of written kind of funny. It looks like it says 0.1%, okay? It's kind of written kind of funny for, and they had 5 deaths in Birmingham, so more than 5 times the deaths, if I'm reading that number right, but it's still very dramatic during the vaccination period of Leicester, all of these towns, both of these towns showed roughly the same amount of deaths, roughly the same amount of infections. When Leicester refused vaccines, their health grew, and Birmingham, which continued to vaccinate, they went downhill even more. That's very telling.
It is very telling, and it's stuff that those of us who have studied it out already know, because we've seen the health change in our own families compared to that of, let's say, my nieces and nephews. But, you know, I think in those numbers, Kurt, I just want to make sure that you're accurate. Didn't they say that the numbers they're giving them is tens of thousands?
Yeah, per 10,000 population. So when you're talking Leicester had 20,000, I'm sorry, I thought I said that. It was 327 in Leicester, 327 smallpox cases per 10,000. So with a population of 200,000, I'm horrible at math. That's why I do radio.
You're good.
But that is each one of those numbers is per 10,000.
Right. That was the only thing I wanted to make sure that we clarified. That was all, because I remember reading that and thinking, oh my goodness.
Yeah, and that's a lot. When you think about it. But there again, we're still seeing, you know, let's just look at the number without worrying about the 10,000 population. Out of 327 affected in Leicester with smallpox, only 35 died. I really did have that impression that smallpox, to this day, they kind of give you, we eradicated smallpox, that plague of the, you know, 17th and 18th centuries and 19th centuries. And, you know, I mean, I'm sorry that many people died, but I always thought it was such a worse disease, you know? I always had that impression.
Right. Well, and as we're finding out with lots of these other diseases, too, even nowadays, you can recover from them.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, not as many people die from measles and mumps, and we do have this, you know, more sanitation nowadays. We do, you know, of course, some would say that it's because of, you know, herd immunity, and the rest of us are just, you know, parasites because we're sucking and reaping the immunity structure from those who have been vaccinated. But really, I mean, let's look at the whooping cough vaccine. It's done formulated itself into a whole new different thing. It's kind of grown into a superbug, and now those who are getting vaccinated for whooping cough are actually getting whooping cough. History will repeat itself, as we're seeing.
And not only are they getting the whooping cough, but they're getting a far more virulent form of whooping cough because it's genetically modified.
Correct.
That's one thing that really scares the hell out of me. And you know, we've talked about it before with the, you know, these diseases that were very common, say back 20 or 30 years ago. They vaccinated us for it. And these relatively benign diseases that we caught and got through when we were children, these kids aren't getting it. And that disease isn't getting in the body, and it's allowing far more dangerous diseases to take that space up. We're seeing that with pneumonia. So
yeah, or chickenpox and shingles, right?
Right, exactly. But you know, they got a vaccine for that too, so.
Exactly. Well, you know, one of my favorite things about Leicester is when they realized they were dropping like flies, and this, I wrote this down, I put I Heart 1872, the citizens revolted in mass.
Yeah, they did. And it really was one of those things. And that's eventually what's going to happen throughout the Western world, is we're finally going to have to say, and I don't know when that point is going to be, where people say, you know what, it's not normal to have every third child with an inhaler, every second child going to the nurse's office for Ritalin or Risperidol, and it's not normal to have kids with diabetes and kids with arthritis, and rise up en masse and say, no more.
Well, and that's what that's what the masses did. And they finally got scared. They were like, wait a minute, you know, people will not do this anymore. They're not taking it from us anymore. You know, they call them the poisonous, they call their vaccinators that we're injecting poison. I mean, this is the same kind of terminology that we're using to this day, and it just still blows my mind that they were using almost, you know, verbatim the same terminology that we're using today. And I love that the citizens stood up in mass and they put a stop to it, and that's the only way we're going to be able to do that. Of course, we have a whole lot more hoops to jump through now, but I hope that this can be encouraging to everyone, and that, you know, they will use this information absolutely to their benefit.
Yeah, in fact, what they say is they rose up en masse in open revolt against the propagation of the vaccinators' poison. I mean, they got it. They understood what was going on.
I know, it just puts fire in my bones, because, you know, I started reading this and I was just, you know, just beside myself. I don't know, Kim, I want some feedback from you. You know, you guys have a vaccine in your child. How does it make you feel to know that, I mean, we've got a vax-unvax study, and what would you like to see happen with this information?
Well, you know, they already know. We're going to get this information out to the masses, but they already know. The powers that be already know. It's going to take a pretty big revolution for them to step back. I mean, that's my feeling about it.
Oh, I feel
the
same way.
If they, for how long have they been poisoning generations of children? They're perfectly fine with it. They get up every day and look in the mirror at themselves and their pocketbooks and their BMWs and their glass mirrored buildings that they hide in. It's going to take a heck of a lot more than this book and people talking about this book. I mean, that's my feeling. They have no soul. They have no soul.
No, and I, you know, I definitely have to agree with you. I mean, it's gotten the greed and the profits have just grown. I can't imagine the profit margin that they made back then. You can only imagine now the profits. You know, it's one of the biggest, next to psychotropics, or just as much as psychotropics, it's one of the best money makers for the pharmaceutical companies. One of the things that I wanted to go back and revisit real quick is, you know, they studied this for an entire generation.
Yeah.
And then let's hear this now. They only study what the vaccines for 6 weeks before they fast track them through and start producing them and injecting them in everyone.
Exactly.
They studied this whole thing for an entire generation. The 20 years, that's what they considered to be an entire generation in this book. So yeah, in comparison, you know, it's just gotten quicker and quicker and quicker, so they can just get whatever they make. And another thing that really floors me, real quick, and I'll let you guys get back to everything, Wallace really floors me, because I have found that Darwinism and the theory of evolution and a lot of people who believe in that way, that's where a lot of this, you know, almost like humanism, just absolute rejection of obeying, like, or even holding by our human rights. I find that sometimes is a root cause, and that's one thing some of these scientists share in common, is their belief of human life and how it just basically doesn't matter, and that's why we're these, you know, sheeple that can be injected and our human rights can be violated and it doesn't matter. And that's where they get the concept and idea of herd immunity. Now, I don't think every person who believes in the theory of evolution believes that way, but I'm saying that's a common thread. And so for this Wallace to stand up and go, you know what, this is bunk, this is what Americans call bluff,
right?
Says something to me.
Yeah, there's no it really shows how blatant it would have had to have been to make somebody like that come out and stand against it.
Right. Given, you know, and that's just me, you know, in my personal opinion, and it doesn't have to, you know, weigh in at all on anybody's decision about this, but it spoke to me something pretty great.
Right, there's no doubt. Now, Joni, we are going to be talking in the next week or so. I don't know, do you want to make an announcement or want about why you're coming back on the program now? We've only got about a little less than a minute.
Oh, sure. Well, coming soon is Homegrown Health with Joni Cox on Natural News Radio.
And we are so excited. It's going to be so amazing to have you on board with Natural News right there. You know, you helped me get started with radio back in the day, and now we're going to be compatriots on Natural News Radio, and it's just going to be a blast, and I'm going to love it.
I'm going to love it, too. I can't wait. Thank you so much, guys, for having me on.
All right. Thanks, Joni, and we'll talk to you soon.
Okay.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, thanks for listening to Linderman Unleashed. I want to really thank you. We've even got people calling in or emailing me and saying, dude, you need to be 2 hours. So we're having a blast with the show. I hope y'all are enjoying it. Until next week, have a great weekend.
The gloves are off.
Have a great one.